Live from the Ken and Valerie Baker studio at WHYY, this is Studio 2.
On Thursday, July 2nd, welcome, 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 friends, on Into the Program. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman Arendt. Cherry, most of the time I bike to work.
Yes.
And I lock my bike outside WHYY HQ.
Mm-hmm.
We have some lovely bike racks,
we
by the
do.
Way. And more and more, I'm looking to the left and the right of me and seeing some of our colleagues have pulled in on these e-scooters or e-bikes.
Yeah.
And you've probably noticed them popping up.
They've
become very, very popular, mm-hmm. right? That's called generally micromobility.
Mm-hmm.
And I imagine a lot of those folks, and I know some of those folks would otherwise, if they didn't have an e-bike or an e-scooter, be taking some other form of transit. Could be a bus, could mm-hmm. be a train, could be a car.
Yeah.
And so you see that these e-bikes and these e-scooters are serving a purpose. They're sort of creating this niche of people who can now get places pretty far distances mm-hmm. pretty quickly,
yep.
who otherwise would have been maybe jamming up the roadways. However, the downside here is very real, which is that these things can go pretty fast.
They can.
The regulation around them is spotty, state mm-hmm. to state, municipality to municipality. And they do present some new dangers on our roadways.
Especially for kids, because kids are using them. Yeah,
for sure. And so today we're going to talk about why this type of transit has boomed so much over the last, let's say, 5 to 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to talk about what would be a fair way to regulate them moving forward and what the future of micromobility looks like on our streets. We'd love to hear from you. What do you think about e-bikes and other micromobility options? Do you have one of these devices? Do you see them around? Do you have thoughts about them?
Yeah.
Give us a call, 888-477-9499. Our email is studio2@whyy.org. YouTube, Facebook, drop a comment in the live chat.
And of course, we'd love to hear from you because people do have thoughts about things. You know, do we need more regulation?
People have thoughts about things. They do.
Are, you know, some of these states going crazy with regulations? 888-477-9499. Email studio2@whyy.org. And it is Thursday, which means it is DJ of the day.
I love it. And that means you can submit a song on the topic of today's show, and perhaps you will be picked by EP Kevin to be our DJ of the day. The topic is e-bikes and e-scooters and micromobility.
Transportation.
There's one very obvious song about bicycles that you could pick. I don't know if Kevin will go for that or not. I don't decide. But anyway, submit your selection to studio2@whyy.org before 12:30 for a chance to be our DJ of the day.
Yeah.
But first, a trio of local news stories. Cherry Gregg starts off.
Oh, yes. Mayor Sherelle Parker is defending against criticism over her decision for the city to take over the July 4th concert and celebration. If you didn't know, the outdoor event will run 7 hours. It'll be headlined by Christina Aguilera, Jill Scott, The Roots, and a whole lot more.
Big concert.
And yeah, big deal, big deal. Recent reporting from the Philadelphia Inquirer disclose how the city chose not to go with Wawa Welcome America, which is a nonprofit, for this year's concert, and instead hired a different production company. And that decision, according to the reporting, caused the price of the concert to go from $3 million last year to more than $15 million this year. And here's what the mayor had to say in response to that. Take a look, listen.
I do not apologize to anyone about making sure that the city of Philadelphia, as the sixth largest city in the nation, the birthplace of democracy, we were going to have a celebration that is fitting of to and for our historical significance and prominence, but one that could be seen, respected, and honored, not just in our city and commonwealth and nation, but in the world.
And look, Avi, she said this will be the largest July 4th celebration in the city's history, and it's supposed to be a legacy experience, and she wants to make sure people never forget it. And I should mention that, you know, it's supposed to hit 100 degrees on Saturday, but the city is still expecting 300 people to attend the event.
300,000.
Yeah, 300,000. Excuse me. 300,000. 300,000 people to attend the event. And I'll say that, you know, Avi, we've talked about this. There's been a lot of pressure on the Parker administration and on the city to have a really memorable, Fourth of July and just 250th anniversary celebration. And in the beginning, people were like, y'all not spending enough money. Mm-hmm. It's not big enough. Y'all not thinking big enough. And she wanted to think bigger. That's what she says. And so she's like, I heard that and we're going to make this big and we want everybody to want to watch what we're doing here in Philadelphia.
I totally understand the logic. Mm-hmm. I follow that. I do have some questions about why it took reporting to dig this up, why there wasn't maybe a little more forthcoming about why they're making this change and what the cost difference would be. That said, you could certainly argue that it's money well spent. You could see the city and state have invested in this FIFA Fan Fest thing, and it's been a huge draw and put a really positive spotlight in the city. Hopefully what happens on July 4th will do the same.
Yeah. And I have to say, I mean, this is a different year. Last year, there was the trash strike when it was three, LL Cool J was supposed to perform, but he didn't. And far fewer people came. Also, this year, we have all the World Cup people here. So more people, supposedly, right?
Now let's head down the highway to D.C. for that city's 4th of July celebration.
Oh, yeah.
The Great American State Fair is underway in the National Mall. Among the highlights are a series of booths representing each of the 50 states. As I'm sure you've heard, it has been controversial, with some states refusing participation because they see the event as overly partisan. Pennsylvania does have a pretty robust booth, despite the state government basically bowing out. Governor Josh Shapiro said in the lead up that he could not drum up corporate interest to fund and stock the booth. Senators John Fetterman and Dave McCormick swept in at the 11th hour and did find several corporate partners. Oh. So there's some finger pointing going on about whether Shapiro was really, you know, trying to make this booth happen or not. Regardless, the PA booth now has a lot of stuff, apparently, from the Knoebels Amusement Park. There's Utz Chips on the way. There's a PA Christmas tree, Crayola crayons from Easton. According to the Inquirer, it's actually pretty chock full at this point.
Okay.
The New Jersey booth seems less robust. The Garden State also officially declined participation. NJ.com sent a reporter to visit the booth, and it seems to be, at this point, just stuff from Cape May County.
Okay.
And that was apparently organized by Rep. Jeff Van Drew, who's from Cape May County.
Mm-hmm.
There's a large sand sculpture, some saltwater taffy. So it seems like the PA booth has quite a bit going on in the end. The New Jersey booth, perhaps not so much.
Yeah, and organizers say the fair is scheduled through July 10th. And they say there are booths from all 56 states and territories, and there is federal agency displays, food vendors. There's a Ferris wheel. I saw the picture of that. The thing is huge.
Mm-hmm.
But reporting, and it's all free, by the way, but reporting seems to show that right now, at least, the crowds haven't been robust.
Huge, yeah.
It's been kind of thin reports. And I think part of it is, like you said, some of the states declined to send delegations. Also, when the performers were announced, many of them, you know, pulled out because they said it was too partisan and they didn't participate. But, you know, I don't know if it's going to be great or not. It's still early, but so far, not a huge crowd.
There might be a huge crowd, though, for this event.
Oh, yeah.
Story number three, Cherry.
Great transition, Avi Wilson.
It was all right.
Yeah. There is a Ben Franklin lookalike contest set to take place Friday, July 3rd. You heard me. This is the flyer advertising what will likely be an epic event, and it's gone viral on multiple platforms. There's a picture of Ben Franklin in the middle. And as you can see, it says Night of 250 Benjamin Franklin's Contest, $1 to enter, winner takes the pot. And all the Bens are supposed to line up at the Liberty Bell Friday.
BYO bald cap, it says.
At 5:30. I think this is awesome. And a guy posted a photo of his father with the 18th century Ben Franklin suit and a gray wig on. And in the comments, he said, I'm texting my dad that he has July 3rd plans. And Avi, you can see that picture.
It's
and
okay.
It got me to thinking.
I don't think he's the winner.
Yeah. And it got me to thinking, what does it take to pull off the perfect Ben Franklin? So for those of you who may want to go out there, Avi, we got to have some lists here. I'm thinking you at least need to get the hair right. So you got to kind of have that horseshoe do, or you got to have a fur hat or something on top of that to look like you got a horseshoe do.
I kind of need that. I think mostly what you need is humility.
Yeah.
Because let's be honest, the Ben Franklin of public imagination, he's a little bigger than the average fellow.
Yeah, you could be a little,
doesn't have the fullest portly head of hair. No. So if, you know, if you embrace that you look that way.
Okay.
Go for it.
Go for it. Put some specs on. You can have, you know, the wig. You got to put on the suit. You got
to
at least
try.
It would
be a tough conversation with your friend to be like, oh, I think you look enough like Ben Franklin.
I don't know if you'd be mad if somebody came up to you and say, you know who you look like, Avi?
Look, it wouldn't be my favorite moment.
Yeah.
But not that against Ben Franklin. A lot of respect for him, of course.
Yeah, absolutely.
If someone said he was my celebrity lookalike,
your doppelganger, yes.
Would I go? Would
you be happy?
Would my initial reaction be joy?
I mean, it depends on how old you are. I feel like if you're like, you know, because Ben Franklin, most Ben Franklin photos are, you know, he's older.
He's older. But there is some younger Ben Franklin.
And he looks kind of hot in some of those.
That's true.
But so I don't know if those are AI.
You could come as hot Ben Franklin, right there. Look at that.
That's back when he had hair.
Oh, so when they said I look like Ben Franklin, that's what they meant.
They had a full
that's
head
what
of
they
hair.
Meant. They meant that. They were talking about young Ben Franklin, young B. Frank. I got it now. I got it.
But I'm looking forward
not
to that
offended
contest.
Anymore.
The contest is tomorrow at 5:30. It's going to be epic.
Epic. And welcome back to Studio 2 on WHYY. I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. Electric micro-mobility like e-bikes and e-scooters surged during the pandemic, creating a new rhythm on our streets. Advocates say micro-mobility provides greener, cheaper, and more efficient forms of transportation, but not everyone is buying in.
Many lawmakers have called for more regulation in the wake of high-profile crashes and public outcry. Some of the most restrictive rules in the country are slated to kick in New Jersey in just a couple weeks.
So today we're diving into the electric mobility boom and the future of our roads. And joining us in our Old City studio today is John Boyle. He's the research director at the Bicycle Coalition of Greater Philadelphia. John, thanks so much for braving the heat to be here.
Yes, thanks, Cherry.
You do not look like what you've been through in that heat, so we appreciate that. I also want to welcome Sophia Leibowitz, a reporter doing on-the-ground electric micro-mobility coverage for Streets Blog. Thanks so much for being here, Sophia.
Thanks, Cherry and Avi. It's great to be here.
And we'd love to hear from you. What do you think about e-bikes and other micro-mobility options? Do you use them? Have you seen them around? Do you have concerns? Do you have great hopes? 888-477-9499 is the number. The email is studio2@whyy.org. YouTube, Facebook, drop a comment in the live chat.
And so I wanted to start our conversation, Sophia, with some definitions. And I'm going to put some images on the screen for our YouTube and Facebook folks. But we have some images of what I think people are referring to when they say e-bike or e-scooter or e-motorcycle, and they have these different kind of wheels. They look like regular vehicles that you would see on the road, but they're kind of souped up. And so, Sophia, would you start by telling me exactly what an e-bike, what an e-scooter, what an e-motorcycle is, and the difference between them?
Sure, yeah. So, What can be sort of difficult about this is it can be hard to tell just by looking at what you might think is a bike or a scooter, whether it is an e-bike or an e-moto. But an e-bike, the country has like a 3-class definition system. So that includes class 1, class 2, and class 3. The thing that kind of unites them all is that they all can't have a motor that has over 750 watts of power, and they have to be labeled. Class 1 bikes are just pedal assist and go up to 20 miles per hour. Class 2 bikes can have a throttle, also go up to 20 miles per hour. And class 3 bikes are also pedal assist, but they can go up to 28 miles per hour. But in some areas, it's slightly different. Like where I work in New York City, it's slightly different. But those are the general definitions. And then an e-moto can sometimes look like an e-bike, but it would sort of surpass those regulations. So a lot of times they can have like, you know, 1200 watt motors. You could see them listed online that they go, you know, like 50, 60 miles per hour. They do usually have more of a motorcycle-y look to them, but there are legal e-bikes that also have that motorcycle-y look. So it can be a little bit confusing. And then an e-scooter is, you know, like a stand-up scooter. But it has an electric motor. Yeah. The regulations on those are a little different. It's mostly based on speed. So at least in New York, an an e-scooter can't go over 20 miles per hour to be street legal.
Yeah.
But they also sell pretty high powered ones online. And it's really easy to get them. So,
and my quick follow up for you is, you know, why do you think people, I mean, including police officers, parents, just anyone, often gets really confused about what it is they're seeing when people are sort of, you know, riding around the city or wherever?
I think the confusion comes from the fact that, like I said, the visuals of it aren't necessarily different. But I do want to say that I think if you're going to buy one of these, like, it's important to do the research as a consumer and to know what you're buying, especially like for your children. And then if you're a police officer, you know, I would say that it's on like the local governments to kind of train officers to know what to look for and to give them the tools to actually understand what they are. I know in Europe, they have like devices that can test the power of the motor. So if you are suspicious that this is an e-moto, you could pull someone over and test it out. We don't have those in New York City. I don't believe we have them anywhere in the country. So, you know, I think it's like giving officers the tools and the education to know what they are. It is confusing, but like it is possible to understand it. So I think, yeah, it's important.
Confusing, but possible to understand. Mm-hmm. I think that's about where my head is at right now, Sophia. Yeah. Finally, so just I want to try to summarize this for people. So the things that we can regulatorily classify as e-bikes and e-scooters, their maximum speed is what?
For bikes, the maximum would be 28, because there is a class 3 that can be 28 miles per hour. Mm-hmm. Maximum with a throttle, meaning you don't have to pedal, you just like press a button and go, that's 20.
Mm-hmm.
And then maximum on a scooter, I believe, is 20.
Okay. And John, I want you to explain, John Boyle, research director for the Bicycle Coalition of Greater Philadelphia. I want you to explain why these have become so much more popular in recent years. And it seems to be a lot of people date it to around the pandemic. Is that when you would date the sort of explosion in popularity to around then?
Yeah. And it was also the same time that there's a great article in the New York Times that came out, I believe, like 2 weeks ago that kind of explained what happened with e-bikes and e-motos. So I'll just focusing on the e-motos right now.
Mm-hmm.
Suron, which is a company that imports e-motorcycles, they, around 2018 or so, they started importing these light motorcycles. And
from where?
Probably most likely China. Mm-hmm. I don't have too much background on Suron, Telaria, and some of these other e-moto manufacturers. But they really set the bar because the motorcycle industry felt like they were kind of outpricing people. You had to pay like $30,000, for example, for a Harley. And here we go with these lightweight, silent electric motorcycles that for around $4,000.
So there was like a product breakthrough around 2018.
Yes.
Okay. And these but those what you're talking about, those go faster than 28 miles.
Absolutely.
Per hour. Okay.
So and they are throttle driven. Those pedals, they don't even have pedals, for example.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
There are a lot of knockoffs that came out around the pandemic, but really after 2022, 2023, they started coming up on Amazon and other online marketing places that put on fake pedals or pedals that really weren't used, and they were selling them as class 2 e-bikes.
Okay.
And that was the point where, and the price point dropped.
Got it.
You can get one for $600, for example.
That would be on the cheaper end.
Yes. Okay. And those are the ones you see if you are, for example, I was in Ocean City, I don't know, about a month ago, and four kids came up on e-motos, and they had these low-end bicycles, and I looked them up, and they were, e-motos. Even I make that distinction sometimes. Their top speed was like 32 miles per hour. Their engine was, or their power was something around 1,000 watts.
But overall, so what, I guess just to summarize, what you're saying is around, let's say, 7 to 8 years ago, there was some sort of technological shift that made these more available and significantly cheaper than the alternatives.
Right. And the e-bike boom was parallel to this.
Right. So it's battery technology essentially that has evolved?
Yes.
Okay.
Right.
Okay. And then Sophia, building off of that, like what problem from a transportation perspective, from a mobility perspective, do these types of devices solve? Like who's using them and why? Because it's one thing for it to be cheaper than a motorcycle, but a lot of people don't even want a motorcycle. You know what I mean? Like what is the sort of the rationale for people buying these? What are they using them for?
I'm not really sure. You know, in terms of the illegal e-motos, where it's like they slap pedals on it, it can't be registered at the DMV because it's not legally a motor vehicle, but it's not legally an e-bike either. I don't know that that really serves any purpose. I think people find them to be fun. I think that they're like
sure.
thrill-seeking people will get them. I think kids like them because it's just like a fun thing to do with your friends. It has like a dirt bike kind of look.
Yeah.
I think that the vehicles that like solve a problem are actual legal e-bikes, you know, mm-hmm. like maybe one that you can haul your kids to school on that's like a pedal assist, or one that's a cargo bike where you can go get groceries. Maybe you, you know, you live in like a suburban town that doesn't have good public transportation, but they're starting to put in bike lanes. You can get a legal e-bike and go do your errands that way. I think those solve so many problems, and you know, they allow us to rely more on
replacing some like shorter term car trips,
yeah.
shorter exactly. distance car trips, maybe even car trips that would involve hauling some large, whether it's people, other people, or lots of cargo.
Right,
you can now
right.
do that without a car.
Right. Or if you're older, or if you just like don't want to show up to work sweaty,
right.
you know, things like that. It's like, oh, you can work in New York City. We have bridges like going into Manhattan. You can ride over the bridge and not sweat, you know, things like that. But I don't think that the illegal e-motos really solve a problem. I think they're really just like
toys,
like a quote unquote toy. Yes, they're a toy. Exactly.
Yeah. By the way, I want to remind our listeners that we'd love to hear from you. What do you think about e-bikes and other micro mobility options? What is your take on this boom on these e-bikes, e-motos, and e-scooters? And do you think we need more regulation? If you are an owner of one of them or you have experiences, we'd love to hear from you. 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. And for our YouTube and Facebook streamers, you can put your comments in the chat. Alita says, I do own an e-bike and I used it often to get to my job, which is only about 10 minutes away. But I like beating the traffic so that I can be there on time. While I live in Northern Chester County towards Pottstown, there are no sidewalks nor enough of a shoulder on the roads currently. So riding an e-bike, walking or running could be dangerous. And I'm an advocate for safety for all. That's Alita's experience. And so I want to talk about some of the dangers of these, you know, because John, I want to talk about some of the dangers that you've seen with these, because a lot of people, you could, and my bonus daughter has one. She has a little scooter that she rides around, paid a few hundred dollars for it. And you know, she doesn't have a driver's license necessarily, you know, didn't really want to drive a car. But you know, she's been riding bikes her whole life, and this was like an easy, quick, inexpensive option. And so she's 20 though. And a lot of people get them when they're a lot younger. Can you talk about some of the dangers that these types of e-vehicles pose when we think about micromobility and what folks have been seeing?
Yeah, and I think, you know, sort of like we've had the conversation about e-motors here, but yeah, we could talk about e-scooters and low-speed e-bikes as far as, because it's almost like two different subjects, right?
Yeah.
As a person who's been raised and been a regular bike commuter for 30 years, I find that bicycles and e-bikes have more stability than e-scooters.
Mm-hmm.
But I think what you find is that people who did not have that experience, apparently there's a lower bar, I believe, to riding an e-scooter for a lot of people. And there are issues. And, you know, we have seen, like, I think CHOP has put out some reports such as they've been seeing more internal injuries with crashes. But the overall thing is that the physics is almost the same as a regular bicycle.
Mm-hmm.
There's a little bit more weight with the battery, 9-10 pounds, could be a little bit more. But a car weighing 2,000 pounds or an EV weighing 6,000 pounds, it really is physics, and we need safer streets. We need protected bike lanes, much like we have here right by the studio on Reese Street, like that type of high-quality facility. We need more of that because it's the interaction between vulnerable road users, such as people riding e-scooters or bikes or people on foot, and motor vehicles, which are going at a much faster speed and carry a much faster weight. So that has been kind of the in the conversations that I've been seeing, that has been kind of ignored when it comes to e-bikes and e-scooters.
And what has been ignored?
The interaction with cars. Often these crashes that are being publicized, it's very possible that they could have been done. It could have happened to anybody riding anything. And many of the high-profile e-moto crashes have been very young kids riding very fast and hitting fixed objects. And it, whatever the situation is, if you are in a crash on an e-bike or an e-scooter, that kind of becomes the story,
because,
not the circumstances of what caused it.
Let me ask you, though. This is a question from Deborah. Could you help me understand the difference in speed, weight, and force between one of these e-vehicles and an old-fashioned bike? Curious because as a non-driving pedestrian, I was once hit by a bike messenger on a regular bike. It was painful. I'm wondering if these pose more danger in accidents to drivers and the people they hit. You know, so like that's one of the issues with cars, as you mentioned, is that they're heavier and they go faster. So if someone makes a mistake, it's more likely to be a costly mistake. Now, obviously, an e-bike is not as heavy or as fast as a car. However, it could be heavier or faster than the alternative if that person had been on a bicycle or had been walking a normal bicycle. So can you, John, tell us what the sort of like physical force difference is between a standard bike and, let's say, a street legal e-bike?
So my e-bike that's parked over at the Franklin Square Paco station across the street, weighs 38 pounds. I would say that's the top end of sort of a steel pedal bike. But I think when we talk about weight differential and speed, there's also a speed differential between pedestrians and bicyclists, right? And this is something that we've talked about for a very long time. Bicycles on sidewalks, I've been a bike advocate for 30 years in the city. The issue that has never gone away is bicycles and sidewalks. Now it's e-bikes on sidewalks. And again, it goes back.
Maybe that question is, does it raise the stakes at all? If, let's just imagine, I'm totally making numbers here. If you take 50% of normal bike riders and turn them into e-bike riders, does it change somewhat the safety equation for those cases when someone does ride on a sidewalk or rides unsafely, or you said, like you said, just as joyriding and maybe hits a fixed object? Because I think that's where, and I'm just picking up on what our commenters are saying, I think that's where some of the concern might come from. I don't think anyone's arguing that they're more dangerous than cars.
Yeah, the answer is they can be faster, they can be heavier. So yes, it comes to physics. Yeah. But how do you solve that problem has not been addressed.
Yeah, I mean, we're going to get to that for sure.
And let's bring in a caller. We have Zoya from Quakertown on the line. Zoya, you're on Studio 2. What's your question or comment?
Along the lines of what you've been discussing is the danger of these for pedestrians and regular bicyclists. I also live in New York, and the e-bikes are all over the place. The drivers don't seem to know the rules of the road. I don't know if they've been tested. And it's a big problem. I personally know two people who have been killed by e-bikes not following the rules of the road.
I'm sorry to hear that, Zoya.
I'm sorry about that, Zoya. And I'd love to get your take on this. And by the way, our question of the day is, we'd love to get your thoughts. What's your take on the boom of e-bikes, e-motos, and e-scooters? Do we need more regulation? 888-477-9499 to email us studio2@whyy.org. Sophia, would like to get your take on some of the dangers that these pose. We've seen this spike in the number of people going to the ER. You heard from Zoya, who actually had people hurt and killed because of this. And your thoughts?
Yeah, I would say that, you know, just, we know what works in terms of like making streets safer. And I do think the same things work when it comes to redesigning streets to minimize the damage done by the all types of vehicles. So like we know with Vision Zero, there's the three E's, there's enforcement, education, and engineering. So enforcing the rules that exist, like we were when we were talking before, are they more dangerous? I think that's why we have these regulations on the wattage of the motor, because a lot of it comes to acceleration. And if you keep the motor under a certain wattage, then you don't have the differentiation in acceleration from like a pedal powered bike to an electric powered bike. And then engineering is, you know, redesigning streets, evidence-based engineering, and then education, which is, I think, what Zoya was kind of talking about. If she feels like in the city, a lot of e-bikers aren't following the traffic laws, I think education is a big part of it. I know in New York, like, obviously, we have a huge delivery industry, and we have a conservative estimate of 80,000 delivery workers that mostly ride e-bikes on the city streets. The app companies that they work for aren't really required to do much in terms of like training them.
And Sophia,
independent contractors.
We are coming up to a break, so hold that thought. But we're going to talk a lot more about regulatory frameworks and possible solutions. Talking about e-bikes and micro-mobility this hour on Studio 2. We'd love to hear your take. Studio 2 at WHYY.org, the number 888-477-9499. We'll be right back on Studio 2. And welcome back to Studio 2 on WHYY. I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. We've been talking about e-bikes this hour and the debates around them. And now we want to bring in a local lawmaker who has spent a lot of time thinking about this issue.
State Senator Tim Carney represents parts of Delaware County in the Pennsylvania State Senate, including Media and Upper Darby. He's a Democrat who's been pushing for more regulation around e-scooters for the last year. State Senator Carney, welcome to Studio 2.
Hi there. Good to be with you.
It's nice to have you. I would love to have you describe your proposed legislation and also why you proposed it.
Well, sure. We had we're calling it Abby's Law, and it's because a year ago we had a real tragedy here in Delaware County where we Abby Gillen lost her life, and Bella Jones, who's also riding on the scooter with her, is still recovering from injuries, actually. But it really just showed us how kids were using these scooters in ways which were frankly not safe. And we needed to try to come up with ways of, you know, clarifying exactly what it is that, you know, who can ride the scooters, when they can ride them, where they can ride them, and certainly until they're 18, wearing helmets. So the bill actually would make it you had to be 16 in order to be able to ride them. You had to wear a helmet until you're 18, kept a speed limit of 20 miles an hour, basically just trying to keep kids and adults safe.
And right now, State Senator, are they completely unregulated? What are the rules in Pennsylvania around these e-scooters? And to clarify for folks, we're talking right now about the e-scooters, the stand-up scooters.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But right now, they're actually there's nothing on the books in Pennsylvania. We're the only state in the country that's left that doesn't have anything at all, even defining what they are. So we need to get them into the motor vehicle code. We need to sort of, you know, because right now we just have a Wild West kind of environment. There, people are using them. We see them literally all the time, using them in ways which are, you know, kind of wildly unsafe.
So what had you been hearing from the community or just around this that sort of prompted you? Because, you know, I'm sure it's very different in Delaware County than what we see and on the urban streets of Philadelphia.
Well, they're similar and different at the same time. I think what we see is a lot of kids riding them, and a lot of kids riding them without helmets, a lot of kids riding them in ways that, you know, they just don't really understand the rules of the road yet. So we're trying to clarify it, basically provide, that's actually what we've heard from law enforcement mostly, and from municipalities, is that they just want to know what the rules are. And right now there aren't any rules.
Yeah. Is there any effort to do some education? Because one of the things that we were just talking about is education and enforcement. And just sort of, have you thought through that as you work through this legislation?
Yes, we have an education component to the bill. We're pushing it through. It would involve things like adding a question onto the driver's test, the written test through PennDOT, dealing with, because you get, you know, it's not only the people riding the scooters that you have to educate, it's also the people driving the cars. And so we need to figure out ways of again, putting together educational materials, putting together ideas so people know exactly how to safely use them on the roads.
Well, that's State Senator Tim Carney, representing the 26th District, parts of Delaware County. Thank you so much, Senator, for your time today on Studio 2.
You're welcome. Glad to be with you.
Before we get back to some of our callers and commenters, I just want to talk about regulation with our guests here first.
Yeah, I wanted to reintroduce our guest. John Boyle is the research director at the Bicycle Coalition of Greater Philadelphia. Sophia Leibowitz is a reporter doing on-the-ground electric micromobility coverage for Streets Blog.
And okay, so we've kind of established, right, that they're obviously not cars, these micromobility transport methods. They're not cars. They're not as heavy. They don't go as fast. They're also not bikes, right? And so people look at cars and they say, in order to drive a car, you should absolutely need to pass a test, have a license, be registered, have a license plate, et cetera, go through all these rules. To ride a standard bike, a pedal bike, you know, basically just buy it and ride it, right? And I think the big question is, here's this thing in the middle. Should it be more like a car or should it be more like a bike in terms of the rules around how to get one, how you need to show proficiency or not, et cetera, et cetera. So, John, what's your answer to that question? Not talking about specific rules here, but just a framework for approaching it.
Right. So there's a broad spectrum, right, between the emos we've been talking about and the class one e-bikes. And, you know, somewhere in there is the low-speed scooter. So scooters also have powerful motors on certain ones, and they can go 60 miles per hour, and you – every once in a while, I do see one going very, very fast.
So given that, what do you think should be the basic approach to government, for government, to these this class of vehicles, right? Because on one hand, you could say if everyone was riding them 28 and below, we would take this approach. But if we have to acknowledge that some people are souping them up or they're changing them, and it's very hard for us to tell what is what, then maybe we want to take a different approach. What would be your approach?
So personally, 28 miles per hour is very, very fast if you're on a two-wheel vehicle bouncing yourself. So that might be my bias. But I do think that 20 miles per hour is very close to what pedal bikes, you can easily be passed on an e-bike by someone on a road bike. It happens to me every day. Mm-hmm. It happens to me on a Ben Franklin Bridge climbing up the hill or climbing up the span. So you have that on one end, and the lower speed e-scooters, they should be treated more like, they should be treated as bicycles because they are pedal assist. They are assisting the rider, or if they have a disability, the throttle is helping them. It also can help people going up the hill. As we get into higher and more powerful engines, so the right now sort of like the baseline for the class 3 e-bike is 750 watts. That is equal to 1 horsepower. 45 states have defined that as the point of this is a bicycle and anything that's above that is not. And in fact, the CPSC, Consumer Product Safety Commission, that's exactly how they define bikes federally, as Sophia explained earlier. And when you go above that, they are motor vehicles, whether they're off-road or on-road. So a lot of these e-motos are really electric dirt bikes.
And you agree with that. And you think that the process you should have to go through in order to be able to ride one of those should be what exactly?
It should be if they are road ready, do they have blinkers, do they have a VIN number, all those things that you need for safety reasons, go out and get a motorcycle license and register them.
And would you need insurance? Like
yes,
anything
right.
else under the motor
right.
vehicle?
I just bought e-bike insurance, so.
Yeah. Oh, interesting.
Which is another topic that we can cover later.
Yeah. By the way, our question of the day for you, our listeners, is what's your take on the boom of e-bikes, e-motos, and e-scooters? Do we need more regulation? If you've had an experience, please share it with us. 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. And for our Facebook and YouTube streamers, you can put your comments in the chat. Hal says, I ride a bicycle. None of these motorized vehicles should be in bicycle lanes. They pose a danger to cyclists. Catherine from Abington says, e-bikes and e-scooters are very cool, but they go too fast for safety. There should be speed limits built into the bikes, and we need mandatory helmet laws. Ask any ER doctor. Injuries from e-bikes and e-scooters are increasing in frequency and severity. I want to bring in a caller. We have Tiffany from Medford on the line. Tiffany, you're on Studio 2. What's your question or comment?
Thanks for having me. I just wanted to note that I think especially for those who don't have a license, those under the age of 18, there should definitely be more rules and policies in place. We recently just lost a teenager that was days away from his 17th birthday because he was riding his brother's e-bike and he crashed into a UPS truck.
Wow. I'm so sorry to hear that. Thank you,
Thanks
Tiffany.
Thanks for sharing that, Tiffany.
From Medford. And I'd like to, you know, hear from you, Sophia. I know New Jersey has a new law that imposes licensing, registration, and other requirements on many e-bikes. And people argue that it's, you know, going to be too restrictive or it's very restrictive. Could you tell us a little bit about what New Jersey is planning to do and then give us your take on it?
Yes. So I just want to start by saying I think that it, like, similar to what John said, you know, this there we can't lump all of these things together because they are different. I think what we need is a standardized system throughout the country in order to so that the rules are just easier for manufacturers to follow. I think that we need to focus on the wattage of the motor because that is actually what determines the speed more so than the speed limit on the bike, because that can really easily be changed. It's basically a computer system. If there's enough wattage there, you can up the speed. You can do it aftermarket. You can do whatever you want. So I think that that is what has to be focused on. I don't think just because somebody finds one that has a 2000 watt motor that goes 60 miles per hour that somebody using one with a 250 watt pedal assist should have to get a license and registration. I don't think that makes sense. I think as a society, we can, like, differentiate these things. In New Jersey, they didn't take it that way. You know, they decided let's require licenses for all bikes with any sort of electric component. And, you know, this kind of goes back to what we were saying. I've talked to emergency room doctors. There was a study in New York about emergency room visits from, it specifically looked at people who were riding electric micromobility and pedestrians. So it took cars out of the equation. And even the doctors I spoke to and the experts said, you know, the best thing for this would be to have more protected bike lanes, because most of the people that were going to the emergency room that were on e-bikes were getting hit by cars. So, you know, even in the state senator in New Jersey, Nicholas Scutari, who introduced the e-bike bill that got passed, when he introduced it, he cited three cases in New Jersey. You know, a truck driver killed a 13-year-old boy who was on an e-bike, a motorist hit and killed a 22-year-old in Orange, New Jersey, and then a teenage hit and run driver killed two teen girls who were on e-bikes. So those are all situations where I don't know that if that e-bike was licensed, like, would that have saved their lives? Mm-hmm. I don't know. I think, you know, we need to drill down on the rules we have, make them clear, and be able to separate these things and be able to know what's safe and what's not safe and listen to the experts about it.
But could two things be true at the same time? Could there be some type of need for a multi-prong approach? Maybe some class of these bikes, like you said, or some type of training and education on for these bikes be part of the component while you also work on upgrading the streets and making things safer? I mean, can two things be true at the same time?
Yeah, I don't see issues with education at all. I just think that a lot of what we're talking about here, these vehicles are not street legal already. I just think we have to, and I don't really think we should even make them street legal by licensing them. They don't have VIN numbers. They don't have, you know, they actually can't be licensed. There would have to be like a new licensing structure for them because they're just not street legal vehicles. They're toys that are supposed to be used on private courses. And they're getting marketed incorrectly. So I think it's like a really big consumer issue. Like,
and you're talking about the e-motos.
Yeah, the e-motos, they're marketed as e-bikes, but they're fully not legal. And to say you have to license an e-bike is not going to stop someone from just ordering an illegal e-moto online, because that wouldn't even have to be licensed because that can't be licensed in either scenario because it's not a motor vehicle and it's not an e-bike.
Let me read this comment real quick from Mike in Reading. Many of the worst injuries are among adolescents and children. Mike says, parents, don't get your kids an e-bike until at least 16 or 18. We have a couple other comments in that vein. I want to ask one more follow-up question to you, Sophia, about the New Jersey regulatory framework because it does stand out. What's the downside of making someone, even with a low wattage e-bike, get a license? Because, and I ask that sort of in a leading sense, because it does seem like the fact that you don't need to get a license, you don't need to go through a regulatory process to get one of these, is part of the appeal and is what draws some people to this form of transit. So is the concern here in a place like New Jersey that you're basically going to snuff out the market for these lower speed e-bikes?
I do think part of the appeal is the ease of it. I think that, you know, for some people, they might not have a driver's license. They might not want to go through that. I know there's like immigrant communities rely on them for work in terms of the delivery apps. So if you're dealing with varying, you know, sort of immigration statuses, I think that that can be a barrier. I also think that a lot of times the DMVs aren't really equipped to handle this sort of thing when it comes and the insurance companies as well. So like something will get passed and then like I had heard from people in New Jersey when they had a different version of this passed before this one that was a little less restrictive, like somebody would try to take their e-bike to the DMV and the DMV would just be like, I don't know what to do about this. Because so I think that like a lot of times the cart comes before the horse with that. So I think those are some downsides. And
John, did you want to weigh in there on that? What you see as potential downsides of this New Jersey law?
Yeah, I think Sophia has pretty much covered a lot of them. I think what's happening at the MVC now, the Motor Vehicle Commission, is chaotic. And for exactly the reason that Sophia brought up, is that they are not ready. I should also, and we should affirm, like, these e-motos have never been legal. And now some of them are, if you get a license, if you go to the MVC, they are legal. So it kind of has the opposite effect.
So you think it can make things more dangerous because now if I'm going to go through the process to get one license, maybe I might as well get one of these fast ones that I can.
There's a lot of unintended circumstances that come out of this. For the other thing about licensing, you asked about licensing. So 600,000 New Jersey adults do not have a driver's license for various reasons. And it is often because of either neurodivergence, physical disability, a medical condition. They would have to apply for an e-bike license. And so that is a problem. The other weird thing is that if you are on a suspended license, 400,000 New Jersey residents have had their licenses suspended, and studies have found, including one from CHOP, that 3/4 of those people, 300,000 people, are still driving, and they are not allowed to get an e-bike license.
Yeah.
So mobility, the whole, it's pretty amazing because this is such a mobility gift, micromobility. The reason that bicycles never really took a huge percentage of people using them is that it's difficult to get around. The roads are terrible, but also people don't like pedaling far. And if those barriers are overcome, we see people using it. And in my suburb, that's pretty obvious.
We'll have to leave it there, but I want to thank our guests today on Studio 2. Sophia Leibowitz is a reporter for Streets Blog. Sophia, thanks for lending your wisdom this hour on Studio 2.
Thank you both, and thank you, John. This was really fun.
And thank you, John Boyle, Research Director at the Bicycle Coalition of Greater Philadelphia. Appreciate your time today on the program.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, thanks to everybody who called in today and all the folks who wrote in. We appreciate you. And we reminded you that it is Thursday, which means it's DJ of the Day. And now it is time to reveal our Studio 2 DJ of the Day song selection. Al.
Drum roll.
Hit it.
Round, round, get around, I get around,
yeah,
get around, round, round, I get around,
I get around,
get around, round, round, I get around.
You probably figured it out, but that's I Get Around by the Beach Boys from 1964.
Song about cars.
Yeah.
By the way.
Yeah.
I mean, okay. Look, I don't know what the submissions were.
Mm-hmm.
I can't judge EP Kevin. Seems a little strange.
Yeah.
But I get it. I get around. We're talking about getting around. I get it. Okay, so thank you to Barbara S. for choosing that song and being our DJ of the day. It is a great song, by the way.
It's
a bop.
And somebody might be inspired by this scooter conversation to write something new. So you never know. And by the way, I got to say thank you, of course, to our producers, Debbie Builder, Hazel May Bryan, Paige Murray Besser. Mike Schiffler is our visual producer. Al Banks and Tina Calique engineered today's show. Our executive producer is Kevin McCrory. Joan Isabella is WHYY's audio general manager. From Studio 2 here at WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Cherry Gregg.
I'm a real cool head. I'm getting real good bread. I'm Avi Wolfman Arendt. We'll talk to you soon. I get around, I get around.